made a public information request in El Salvador to determine the identities officially of the Venezuelans and Salvadorans that were sent to the CECOT. That request was denied. We also presented 76 different habeas corpus claims with Venezuelan families to try and confirm their whereabouts and their identities. Also, those claims were not responded to by the Salvadoran court. So, in a sense, these people were sent to a judicial black hole. They were disappeared with no access to their families. The CECOT itself is a prison where, up to this point, nobody has left. In fact, that's one of the novelties of this report that we're publishing today, is it's the most complete information that we have of conditions inside CECOT, as these are the first individuals who have ever left. Amy, it's important to remember that the Venezuelans were constantly threatened and reminded that they would never leave CECOT alive. It's a prison that was created not as a place where people serve sentences after due process and convictions, rather a place where people are sent for permanent punishment and separation. There was a group of family members, Venezuelans, who came to El Salvador to attempt to visit them, to activate different institutions in the state of El Salvador to be able to find access, and they were all denied. This is a prison system that operates in the shadows and outside of rule of law.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Noah Bullock, Executive Director of Cristosal, human rights organization working across Salvador and Central America. Cristosal co-authored this new report with Human Rights Watch titled, You've Arrived in Hell, Torture and Other Abuses Against Venezuelans in El Salvador's Mega Prison. And we want to thank Juan Papier, the America's Deputy Director at Human Rights Watch, which just republished this report that we'll link to at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the U.S. expands its military presence in Latin America, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth declared earlier this week the Pentagon's now on a war footing. In a major speech, Hegseth called for weapons companies' executives to speed up production of weapons for the military.
Every dollar squandered on redundancy, bureaucracy, and waste is a dollar that could be used to outfit and supply the warfighter. We must wage an all-out campaign to streamline the Pentagon's process, to unshackle our people from unproductive work, and to shift our resources from the bureaucracy to the battlefield. Our objective is simple. Transform the entire acquisition system to operate on a wartime footing, to rapidly accelerate the fielding of capabilities and focus on results. Our objective is to build, rebuild the arsenal of freedom.
We're joined now by William Hartung, co-author of the new book, The Trillion-Dollar War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. Bill Hartung, a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Bill, welcome back to Democracy Now! How unprecedented is the Pentagon budget at this point and what the military is doing? I mean, for example, even President Trump, in his executive order, renaming the Department of Defense the Department of War, although only actually Congress can officially do that.
Well, the Pentagon budget has never hit $1 trillion before, and even its most ardent supporters kind of didn't believe we would ever hit this mark. But now that they're there, all bets are off. And speeches like that by Pete Hegseth are basically saying, not only are we going to spend $1 trillion, there's not going to be rules. You know, we're not going to have independent testing of these weapons. We're not going to vet them for human rights when we export them. It was basically a gift to the arms industry. And you know, they talk about speeding it up. When it comes to weapons, speed kills.
So, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, Bill, I wanted to ask you about the increasing shift in the military machine of the United States from actually troops to machines, this shift of this new defense industry that has arisen from Silicon Valley, that I guess dreams of being able to fight wars without losing any human beings and just depending on remote control, killing abilities, robots, AI. You talk about that, to what degree this has moved forward?
Well, it's definitely moving. I mean, in Washington, the two ways to make money are mention China, mention AI, or if you mention both, even better. And it's part of a long myth that technology can win wars, which didn't happen in Vietnam, didn't happen in Iraq, didn't happen with Reagan's alleged leak-proof missile defense. So, they're selling kind of a bill of goods that's kind of stale. It's old ideology with new software. And they're much more aggressive than the head of, like, Lockheed Martin, who might say to his shareholders, oh, you know, this turbulence is going to create business for us. You know, Palmer Luckey's saying, we're going to have war with China in 2 years. We're going to bury them. We're going to have more ammunition. They're sort of acting like they're in charge of our foreign policy. And they view themselves as almost the new technological messiah. So I think their ideology and their political influence is almost as dangerous as the weapons they want us to use.
And in your book, you have an extensive discussion of the war on Gaza and how U.S. companies have the Gaza war became big business for U.S. companies. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, there's this mythology in the Pentagon that sending arms is better than sending troops because our troops aren't at risk and countries will, quote, defend themselves. But of course, Israel is committed genocide in Gaza. It was not defense under any terms. And when you're sending weapons, all the money goes to the companies. You're not doing troops. You're not doing logistics. It's almost pure revenue. And, you know, when you say it's military aid to Israel, it's really military aid to Lockheed Martin and Palantir, because the money rests in Israel, comes right back to them. Palantir even had its board meeting in Israel during the Gaza war and tried to get other companies profiting from the war to be more vocal in their support of Israel. And of course, they also gave them software to accelerate the bombing. So it's one of the more shameful episodes in the history of an industry that, of course, is not based on morality. It's based on profit. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people who are kind of, you know, into tech are like, oh, these are amazing people. You know, they put, rockets in space. It'll be cheaper and so forth. But we'll pay a big price if we put our trust in these companies. And of course, they're very much into the Trump administration, including J.G. Vance, who was groomed in Silicon Valley and is a creature of Silicon Valley and owes Peter Thiel essentially his career. When he was appointed VP, the champagne corks went off in Silicon Valley and huge amounts of money came in behind Trump. So they're trying to basically displace these huge companies like Lockheed Martin. And what the government's going to do is pay off both of them. I mean, Golden Dome is going to have, you know, hardware by Lockheed Martin, software by, you know, Anduril and other companies. So that just means that $1 trillion is going to be in the rearview mirror in a few years if we don't fight back and fight back hard, which means not accepting the myth of, you know, technological superiority.
You have two fascinating chapters in this book, the militarization of American science, buying the ivory tower, and capturing the media, how propaganda powers the war machine. Talk about both.
Well, you know, this move towards AI and advanced tech means they need the university folks more, because Lockheed Martin doesn't have those kind of people. They're prized now, and so they're doing much more recruiting, sending much more money. Johns Hopkins gets $1 billion a year to work on things like ballistic missiles. But the average student there wouldn't know it. The lab is 40 miles away. They're occupied with other things. Berkeley helps run a nuclear weapons lab. If you walked into a student on the quad, likewise, they would not know that. So they're accelerating that, and also the pipeline from engineering students into the weapons industry. And, you know, the media, well, you know, between, you know, vetting Hollywood scripts, spokespersons from think tanks funded by the weapons industry, just the framing, you know, very few outlets now really do deep critiques of the military. And then on top of that, they're not covering it. You know, some papers don't even have a Pentagon reporter anymore. So they just print up the, you know, Pentagon press release, and then paragraph 32, somebody like Bill Hartung makes a little quote so they can, you know, say they're being balanced. But the whole framing is pro-military, and there's this notion that if something happens in the world, if we don't respond with the military, we're, quote-unquote, not doing anything. Of course, whenever we do it, it's disastrous. I mean, you have a member saying, oh, peace through strength. Well, we haven't won a war in this century. We've caused immense harm. We've spent $8 trillion. We've got troops with PTSD in the hundreds of thousands who are not taken care of. And yet that myth persists. So I think there's a it's kind of a cultural, educational task that has to happen, as well as, pulling back the amount of money we're throwing at these companies.
And Bill, you begin your book by citing Trump's 2024 campaign speech in Wisconsin, where he pledged to end endless wars. But ultimately, as you point out, Trump wasn't very different from Biden on many of these metrics. They both turned out to be staunch supporters of the U.S. war machine. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, well, Trump uses that tool when needed. Like when he beat Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton over the head about Iraq, which, of course, he did not oppose when it was happening. And I think this stuff about war profiteering is a message to those parts of his base who are sick of corporate welfare, sick of war. Some have even voted for him because they believed this idea that he was going to be less interventionist. But here we are blowing innocent people out of the water off of Venezuela, continuing to arm a genocide in Gaza, giving away the store to these companies. We'll give you money. We won't regulate you. You'll get to do pretty much what you want. And his first term, he did a similar thing until he cozied up to Saudi Arabia to sell them record amounts of arms and then claim they were job creators in the United States. So he really views the arms industry as a political ally, and he's not going to go after them in any big way. But every once in a while, he'll lapse into that, or at least say we have too many nuclear weapons. But there's no evidence in his policy. In fact, they're increasing spending on nuclear weapons. So it's, he's erratic, but there is a political purpose, which is just to keep that part of his base that's skeptical of war, feeling like, he maybe will do something about it.
Before we end, I wanted to ask you about Axios yesterday reporting Israel seeking a new 20-year security agreement with the United States. While the past agreement promised Israel around $4 billion per year in military aid, and Israel's likely to seek at least that much going forward.
Well, yeah, they want to be kind of a permanent client of the United States and for us to pay for their aggression. And, the current one that runs out had a few little things they didn't like. Like, they used to be able to spend U.S. military aid to build up their own arms industry. That was supposed to come to an end. It certainly will be waived if it's negotiated under the Trump administration. So basically, they're going to, if they do that, they're permanently tying themselves to whatever Israel does in the region. For example, when Israel bombed Iran while the U.S. was supposed to be, negotiating with them, Trump followed right behind. With bombings and false claims about how they'd obliterated Iran's nuclear program. He even, chided some of his own people for acknowledging that that was not the case. So it's one of the worst moves that could be made. It's tying us to an archaic, damaging, destabilizing policy and egging on the worst forces in Israel. So I'm hoping there'll be some pushback. The problem is these deals are often done behind closed doors.
And Bill, one more question about this. In this trade war between the United States and China, the issue of rare earths has continued to come up as a major weakness of the U.S. Military establishment and also obviously in other industry as well. How big an issue do you think this is and a weakness for the United States?
Well, it goes against their notion that they can create this self-sufficient garrison state. Because it's a global economy, and they can't do everything here. They don't have every resource, don't have every technical kind of expertise. So this idea that they're going to have this perfect system all controlled by the United States is a pipe dream. Even at the most dominant moments of the United States in history, we were never completely self-sufficient. So Trump is actually... He's selling a bill of goods that is not possible to actually fulfill, which, of course, is happening in other spheres as well, but is more dangerous when you're talking about peace and security.
Bill Hartung, I want to thank you for being with us, Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new book, co-authored with Ben Freeman, is just out, The Trillion-Dollar War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. Coming up, how did he do it? We'll speak to Zoran Mamdani's field director about his historic mayoral campaign here in New York, fueled by over 104,000 volunteers. Stay with us.
We sitting at the top having our way. Whole city came out to watch us play. We are on a hunt, let's seize the day.
We see you when it's time to slay. Get your popcorn ready. It's a sight to see. Competition heavy. Go hard and compete. Action going steady. It's too close to call. It's about to get messy. We just hear the ball. Play is going off. Tempers start to flare. There's pressure in the air. We just here to win. If someone hurts, then we don't care. Sportsmanship goes out the window when it's never fair. We sitting at the top, having our way. Whole city came out to watch us play. We are on a hunt, let's seize the day. We see you when it's time to slay. We sitting at the top, having our way. Whole city came out to watch us play. We are on a hunt, let's seize the day. We see you when it's time to slay.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show here in New York City, where Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani is less than 2 months away from taking office. The Democratic Socialist will make history as the city's first South Asian and first Muslim mayor, and will be the youngest mayor of New York in more than a century. We end today's show looking at the history-making campaign grounded in community organizing that propelled the little-known state assembly member to victory. Mamdani famously began the campaign polling at just 1% and went on to defeat the disgraced former governor Andrew Cuomo twice, first in the Democratic primary and then again in the general election. By Election Day, more than 2 million New Yorkers had cast their ballots, a level of turnout that hadn't been reached in more than half a century. The campaign was fueled by more than 104,000 volunteers. This is Mayor-elect Mamdani on election night.
This victory is for all of them, and it's for all of you. The more than 100,000 volunteers who built this campaign into an unstoppable force. Because of you, we will make this city one that working people can love and live in again. With every door knocked, every petition signature earned, and every hard-earned conversation, you eroded the cynicism that has come to define our politics.
The person who introduced Mayor-elect Mamdani that night and led the organizing operation was the campaign field director, Tasha Van Auken. She spoke before the mayor-elect at his election rally.
104,000 volunteers. We love numbers. We love metrics. But I want to talk first about what's behind those numbers. Every number is, in a way, an act of bravery. Door knocking is not the easiest thing. For many, including myself, it takes a moment of bravery at the beginning, asking a stranger something about their lives and sharing something about yours. Sharing what you want to see in the world, it can be daunting. Thousands of people did it. And every time every volunteer went to a door and talked to a stranger, they offered their vision to that stranger and invited that stranger to be a part of shaping their vision. We love strangers. Every door knock and every phone call is a statement of belief that politics is for all of us. This campaign and this city is all of ours to shape.
That's Tasha Van Auken, and she joins us now in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! I mean, this election rocked the country and definitely sent a message to the Democratic establishment. You are at the center of it. I mean, how often is the field director the person who introduces the winning candidate? But that's how important you were in this campaign. Talk about your strategy and your experience, how you organized a campaign with Zoran Mandani that started with 1% name recognition against almost 100% for Andrew Cuomo to this massive win.
Thank you, Amy. It is very exciting. And I keep saying to people that I really feel the history in this election and all that has happened that has led to this campaign being possible, the years of organizing that thousands and thousands of people have done that led to this place. I think when we started the field operation in December, We knew that we wanted it to be very big. We had a goal of 1 million doors. And so what we did was we prioritized developing leadership and bringing in as many volunteers as possible. And so the first thing we did was we launched a canvas in about 8 locations across the city in December. Those canvases were anchored by members of the Democratic Socialists of America who had been an early endorser of the campaign and had worked on campaigns prior. So we were able to get a big scale right at the beginning to demonstrate what we wanted to do. And honestly, I mean, from the first canvas that we did, we had folks coming back from doors. We were talking about the three planks, the affordability agenda. So it was fast and free buses, universal childcare, and freezing the rent. And we had such a positive reception from day one when we went to people's doors. We had canvassers coming back who had never done it before, who were quite nervous to do it, who were just excited. And they were like, I had so many amazing conversations. And so that's where we started concretely, was just talking to voters.
And where were you physically in the city? Where were you coordinating all of this?
In my apartment. In December, I was in my apartment. Materials were delivered to my apartment. It was before we had an office. I was the only person on the field team at that point. We were a very small team. There were just a small handful of us. Volunteers came to my apartment, helped bundle things. We got them out to multiple locations. And we launched a canvas and demonstrated what we wanted to do at a massive scale for the rest of the campaign.
And could you talk about also some of your beginnings? Tasha, you started back in 2008 with the Obama campaign in Pennsylvania. Now, Obama was certainly a candidate of hope and change, but certainly not a democratic socialist. And could you talk about this, the impact of the ideology of DSA on the organizing that you did and the differences between this campaign and others you've run?
Sure. Yes. The Obama campaign, I credit that field operation for really setting the bar for me. So I wasn't politically organized before that. I had political leanings. I wanted to participate. I wanted to do something. I didn't know where to go. I think a lot of people feel that way. And so I think about that point in my life a lot. And when Obama won the primary, there was this amazing movement around him. And that is what pulled me into that campaign. And I was lucky enough to get a job in a field office for the last couple months of the general. And when I walked into that, I became part of this incredible organizing operation on his field campaign. The architect of that is Marshall Ganz, incredible longtime organizer. And a lot of the sort of organizing theories that he had put into that field operation really stayed with me through the years. And it's all about leadership development. It's all about this idea that anybody who wants to can learn leadership skills and step into roles of responsibility and learn how to build power with other people.
And he was at the victory party.
Yes.
I was just starting to interview him when you started talking.
Yes, he was there. It was incredible. It's been incredible to meet him and get to know him through this campaign. So I think that's what I really took from the Obama campaign were those organizing philosophies, as well as just like an A-plus field operation technically. And so I think it was many years before I joined Democratic Socialists of America and Bernie ran for president. And I think what changed for me at that point was really understanding how important organization, long-term organization is for building long-term power. You can't house everything in a single campaign. You have to have some place people get activated through these moments of change where they feel like something else is possible, and then they need some place to go to continue having a political home and learning and organizing and experimenting and trying things. And I think that DSA was that for me in, you know, right around when Bernie ran.
And of course, we have the news that just came out of another victory of an insurgent mayoral candidate, Katie Wilson, in Seattle. Also a community organizer, also someone who wasn't expected initially to have a chance. Your sense of how this insurgent progressive movement is taking shape across the country.
Yeah, very exciting. I have my brother lives in Seattle, and his partner sent me that information yesterday. I think that, yeah, moments like this feel very important because they really, you know, the zeitgeist shifts. People start to understand that other things are possible. And it's been overwhelming to hear from folks across the country, all over the place, who are inspired by this campaign and are organizing to change things.
So, Tasha Van Auken, you are still the field director, but the campaign is over. But actually, is it? Because, I mean, you have President Trump threatening to take billions from the city. He even threatened to detain and deport Zoran Mamdani. Clearly going to target him. The response, it seems, is the same as the response in the campaign, is people rising up across the city. You have 104,000 volunteers. Are you keeping them organized? And what exactly would they do? How do you carry out this campaign, from free buses to childcare to city-run grocery stores?
It is a very good question. It is the question, in my opinion. I think from the very first training that we did in January, we've said from the beginning, it is very important for people to see this as one step towards more organizing, and that it is incredibly important to continue organizing after the campaign is over. I think we're in this exciting moment in terms of infrastructure, organized infrastructure that can help move this agenda, as well as help, I think, respond to what might happen. It is also a very scary moment for all the reasons you listed. I think we have this moment where we have organizations, progressive and left organizations in New York City, who are organized and have been building, like I said, like a lot of them building towards this campaign being possible. They will all be organizing. And then I think we also have this exciting opportunity to vision out what the government looks like and to demystify the government and access to the government, access to politics for people. And that, to me, has been at the centerpiece of all of this work, is really like opening up a lane of access for folks so that anybody can consider themselves political, understand and learn what they can do that can actually change and move the needle in our world.
About 30 seconds left, but how do you guard against the movement to demobilize, in essence, that has happened with many progressive movements once they come into power? Even under Obama, the Obama campaign was forced often to contend with those on the ground who were still demanding more change.
15 seconds.
I think it's good for there to be organizing outside of the administration. I think that is good. I think that Zoran and everyone from the campaign is very excited for there to be lots of levels and tiers of organizing.
Tasha Van Auken, we thank you very much for being with us. Congratulations on this momentous, historic win. Field director for Zoran Mamdani's mayoral campaign. And that does it for our show. I'll be in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, tomorrow at the largest international documentary film festival in the world. The film, Steal the Story, Please, will be playing twice. Go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll be right back.
everyone. My name is Connor, the music coordinator here at CJSF, and on behalf of everyone at the station, thank you to all who supported us with a donation during this year's fund drive. Thanks to you, we are rising higher and reaching further.